Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Authentic Woman. This is your host, Shannon Fisher. Thanks for joining us tonight on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. We've got a really important show. And before I introduce my guest, I'm going to tell you the story about how tonight's show came to be. When I was in Philadelphia for the Democratic National Convention, my car was towed. And when my Uber driver, when I gave him the address, he said, "Are you sure this is the address where your car is?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Okay, I will take you there." And he seemed a little hesitant. As we got closer and closer to the area where my car was in lockup, the area just became so much more impoverished. And it would go from, buildings that had been renovated to buildings that weren't quite in upkeep to buildings that had bars on the windows, and then there were boarded up buildings, and then there were buildings that were missing and lots that were filled with overgrown weeds. And as we got closer, there were more and more people actually on the street, some of them doing drug deals on the street corner in plain view in the middle of the day, some prostitutes walking on the street. And most of the stores were closed. The ones that were open had bars on them. And I looked in the eyes of some of these people, and they just all had a 1,000-mile stare, even the children that were on the street. I never knew anything like this existed in the United States. I mean, I've seen poverty around the world, and I've seen poverty in the United States, and I've been in really bad urban areas and extremely impoverished rural areas. But this is a pocket of despondency and detachment and incredible poverty, and it was like I had been driven into another world. So as we got to the place where my car was being held, the Uber driver looked at me and he said, "I'm not leaving you here." And I said, "What?" He said, I'm gonna pretend to be your husband, and we're just gonna go in there, and I'm just not gonna leave until I'm certain that you are in your car and outside of this lot." I said, "Okay, thank you." And so we stepped outside, and as we're walking, he said, "Yeah, I'm not leaving you." And I just looked at him. He said, You spend 10 minutes on this block and nobody would ever see you again." So I get my car. And I'm a little bit curious, struck an emotional reaction. There was this one 14-year-old girl that I just saw walking down the street, and I just thought what her life must be like, the things that she must have seen and experienced, and the fear that she must have felt at certain times living in this basically third world area of North Philadelphia. I wanted to imagine what it was like to try to develop some sort of empathy for this type of life. And I drove around for, it took me a while to get home, and I took a couple of detours, one of which took me down a street that had a bunch of industrial buildings that were completely empty. There were no cars. Clearly it had been some sort of industry that had closed. And I became really curious about the history of it. So when I got home, I did some research. I couldn't get it out of my mind. So in my research, I discovered this area is called the Badlands, and it is one of the worst areas in the entire country. And I came across some papers and some videos about the status of living there, and that is what led me to my guest tonight. He wrote a book called Code of the Street: Decency, Violence, and the Moral Life of the Inner City, and he based it on Germantown Avenue, which is the road on which my car was being kept, and is very well known as one of the main thoroughfares in North Philadelphia, that goes right through the worst area of town. His name is Elijah Anderson, and he is the William K. Landman Jr. Professor of Sociology at Yale University. He also directs Yale's Urban Ethnography Project, and he used to be a distinguished professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And he's been doing research on this topic, specifically in this area, for years and years. And I read the book Code of the Street, and I could not put it down. And we're going to talk about that tonight. And we're going to talk about the things that he learned as he meandered through and interviewed a lot of people in the area. And I could not be more proud and excited to introduce to you Elijah Anderson. Elijah, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you. So we're going to be talking about actually two of your books, The Cosmopolitan Canopy and Code of the Street. You are an ethnographer and you're a sociologist. So will you explain to the audience exactly what ethnography is and how it fits into the greater field of sociology, please?
Sure. Well, ethnography is the systematic study of culture. And culture, for our purposes, is a set of shared understandings that develop as people go about meeting the demands of everyday life. And as they problem solve, they understand, they obtain knowledge, and they share this with others, people they care about. And these become sort of ways of life. People live by these codes, they live by these understandings to some extent. These understandings morph into a kind of a local knowledge, what the community knows, the common sense of the community. Well, the ethnographer is interested in apprehending, comprehending, understanding, and then representing that local knowledge to paint a picture, of the way of life of a people. And that's what I've been doing in my work over the years.
And it is very good work. That the pictures you paint are crystal clear. It is. I was telling him before we started the show that Code of the Street is, it's one of the best books I've ever read. I could not put it down because it was such an ideal glimpse into this world that a lot of people don't even know exists. So a lot of the work that you've done is surrounding the city of Philadelphia. I know you lived and worked in Philadelphia. So what inspired you to take these journeys to this particular line of work?
I care about the city. I care about trying to understand the city. I care about writing about the city, to debate and discuss the issues of the city with my colleagues who are sociologists typically. But my writing is accessible to a wide audience. So people outside the academy become interested in the work as well. But the work is really written for within academia, but also that in the larger society. And when I was coming through graduate school, there were a lot of discussions and debates about these very issues. These were critical issues. And I wanted to contribute to that discussion. And so I began to study the problem. My dissertation was A Place on the Corner, which is a study of Black Street Corner men in Chicago. I was at the University of Chicago when I began that study. And that study, A Place on the Corner, is a study of how people live on a street corner in Chicago. And then I spent the next years in Philadelphia, studying various parts of Philadelphia, living in various parts of Philadelphia, and becoming very, very interested in the issues that were facing Black people in particular, but also the larger society there. And so my books, Streetwise, Code of the Street, The Cosmopolitan Canopy, these works basically try to apprehend the condition of people living in Philadelphia, but also to represent as accurately as possible the lives and life ways of these individuals. And that's what I do in the book. And the ethnographer works by getting close to people, by spending time with them, by walking in their shoes, literally sometimes, eating with them, drinking with them, discussing issues with them, getting close to them, having intimate conversations with them, but then trying to paint an accurate picture of what's going on, not with regard to politics, but hopefully with regard to what people are living and experiencing every day. These works that I've mentioned are ethnographic accounts of life in Philadelphia for the most part.
And I think also Philadelphia is kind of a microcosm of urban America, because a lot of the issues that you discuss that are specific to the individuals and the specific areas in Philadelphia really are all around the country impacting inner city people, especially the deindustrialization. So you interviewed a lot of people in North Philadelphia along Germantown Avenue. It starts on one end in a fairly well-to-do area and then runs down to Interstate 95. And along the way, socioeconomic class changes and the racial makeup changes. So if you could just kind of take us down a little bit of a stroll of Germantown Avenue to give the audience an idea of the makeup of the urban North Philadelphia.
Well, I've lived in various parts of Philadelphia. The Germantown Avenue is one of the oldest streets in the country. It goes back to the Revolutionary War, and the Battle of Germantown was fought on Germantown Avenue. But the at the top of the hill is a setting of well-to-do, essentially white people, but increasingly these people are joined by ethnic minorities, Italians, Irish, Jewish people, black people. But these are middle-class people oftentimes, and it is a cosmopolitan canopy of a sort today.
Now, tell our audience what the cosmopolitan canopy is. You've done a lot of work on this exact topic. So what, in your definition, is a cosmopolitan canopy?
Well, after doing so much work in the city, looking at these urban problems, crime, violence, code of the street, that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
my family moved to Rittenhouse Square. And Rittenhouse Square is the premier park, public park in Philadelphia. Not far from there is the Reading Terminal Market, which is a wonderful place. And as I lived there, I began to see these places up close. And these places are virtual islands of civility and diversity in a sea of racial segregation. Philadelphia is one of the most segregated cities in the country.
Sure.
And it has a storied history. But in Philadelphia, you have these islands of civility where various kinds of people come together. Black people, white people, gay people, all kinds of people, and they get along. It's a superficial getting along, but they get along, you see. People, of course, this is a veneer of civility to some extent. If you dig deep enough, you can see tensions, and sometimes there are tensions in such places. But the canopy is a wonderful place, an island of civility, diversity, where all different kinds of people are sort of trying each other out. They're getting along on the surface, and that's a good thing.
Sure.
But of course, these canopies have fault lines, places where people do have tensions and all. But typically these come and go. The big story is that it's an island of civility that has implications for how we live our lives in the larger society and what we as a country maybe hope for one day. The canopy is a place of diversity and typically of civility.
And so Chestnut Hill is such an area.
Yes, indeed. And my book, Code of the Street, begins at the top of the hill, mm-hmm. Chestnut Hill. And, of course, Germantown Avenue goes through the city. It goes completely through the city, through various neighborhoods that are working class, poor, well-to-do altogether. And as you take the trek down Germantown Avenue, you see Philadelphia in a sense. And that's what I did for this study. I walked the streets of Germantown Avenue from the top to the bottom, through the bad neighborhoods, through the good neighborhoods, through the marginal neighborhoods. I walked the streets and I met people and I took notes. I interrogated people about their lives, their issues, their problems, their concerns. And a lot of that's represented in my book, Code of the Street. And the argument here in the Code of the Street is that we as a country have been going through this process of deindustrialization.
Right.
And when this happens, of course, the jobs, the old manufacturing jobs, go literally out to sea. First to non-metropolitan America, the suburbs, then to Mexico, and then to China, to India, to developing countries, leaving unemployment vacuum in the inner city. The old jobs were relatively high paying, but low skilled, and people without education could work in these occupations and make decent livings. And black people in particular were drawn from the South to work in these kinds of situations. Immigrants were drawn to this country to work in these kinds of situations. But with the deindustrialization, those jobs go out to sea, and the jobs that are left are oftentimes much more complicated And of course, the lowest levels of the emerging economy, the service economy, don't pay people enough money to live, essentially.
Right.
And so as this has been happening, what we have in these urban areas is a kind of structural poverty that knows no color, but it tends to be racialized. Black people, white people, new immigrants, all to some extent are affected by this emerging service economy and the low levels at which they're paid. So there's a kind of structural poverty that goes on, and to the extent that one is black and poor, it's very hard to get out of that. And of course, in the poorest communities, people have developed an underground economy, you know, to deal with it. And the underground economy consists of three prongs. Welfare payments are what's left of those. Low-wage jobs are what's left of those. And then the idiosyncratic, irregular economy of hustling, bartering, begging, and to some extent street crime. And so all of this works to allow people to circulate capital or money within that community. And I talk about this in Code of the Street. Of course, a lot of the transactions that people engage in the inner city poor communities are going on without the benefit of civil law. People don't sue when you have a debt. People sometimes get in your face.
Right.
At the same time, the wider society seems to have abdicated any responsibility to the community. When you call the police in some of these communities, they don't come, or they come late when all the trouble is gone. But by the time the trouble is gone or over, somebody is shot, wounded, killed, whatever.
And that's something that struck me so strongly in your book, is that you said the code of the street is where the rule of civil law ends and the necessity to completely take care of yourself begins. And that is so striking, because when these civil services cease or are minimal, you know, when police don't respond to calls about criminal activity, you are kind of forced to learn to take things into your own hands. And the evolution of that, as you describe, is fascinating.
Yeah, well, people take matters of personal defense mm-hmm. in their own hands. They take responsibility for their own defense and that of their loved ones. And so the coin in the community becomes street credibility. I won't call the police, but I'll deal with you myself. And part of this is because the civil law has eroded in so many of these communities. And when the civil law erodes, street justice oftentimes fills the void. And that's when we have the violence, you see, because as people mediate disputes and what have you, sometimes it does come to that. It comes to violence. And street cred becomes everything. Street credibility in the community at ground zero anyway is high maintenance. You don't get it once and for all, but you have to keep on working it. You have to keep on establishing it. And it's through that establishment of street cred that we have so much violence. And to the extent that the underground economy is prevalent, this has implications for the high violence rates in the communities, the killing that goes on in Chicago and Philadelphia and other places is related to the erosion of civil law and, in many ways, the abdication of the larger society in terms of the police and the economy, you see.
Absolutely. And the isolation and the creation of their own society and their own rule of law, it perpetuates the necessity to get that street cred. And people who otherwise were born into what you describe as two kinds of sets of families, they are the decent families and they are the street families. And children who are growing up in decent households, who are, you know, law abiding and trying to avoid the street code, they have to blend in with that violent element in order to survive. So tell me a little bit about that.
Most Americans don't realize this, but most people living in the inner city are decent mm-hmm. and trying to be decent. But you don't get this from the media. You don't get this from the movies. You don't get this from the television programs that purport to talk about the Black community, you know.
Right.
You know, but there are many, many, many people in the inner city who mimic the family on Little House on the Prairie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but you don't hear about these families. These are the quote unquote decent people, and these are their words. They're not my words. Decent. And there's also the term street, which is not my word. It's a word the people themselves use. You see, the ethnographer is interested in the words and labels that the people themselves use. So street and decent are words that are common in that community. And it's used as a way to distinguish one type of person from another.
Mm-hmm.
And but see, the decent people in the inner city poor communities, because of the abdication or the sense of abdication of the authorities, the decent people are on their own. So they have to deal with people who are street. In order to deal with those people, they have to get street themselves somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
And so they code switch. They go from street to decent oftentimes. They meet circumstances that they need to meet to defend themselves and their loved ones and their families. Many people growing up in the inner city who are able to survive had this exquisite ability to know what time it is, when to be street, when to be decent, and they code switch.
Code switch being switching from the decent values to the street values in order to be a chameleon within their homes and within their communities. And you describe in Code of the Street a situation of one family who sheltered their daughter in such an extreme manner that she was not allowed to leave the house. Other than to go to school. And so what was the thought process behind that, and what would lead a family to be so strict with their child in that environment?
Because the outside environment is considered to be so rough,
mm-hmm.
you see, and so unforgiving. And so to protect your child, you teach them quote-unquote decent values, but you also protect them by keeping them at home. And sometimes this means not even letting them play with their cousins who might be, you know, oriented towards the street, that kind of thing, which was the case. And so, yeah, it's a very tough environment to be sure. But it's really important for people to appreciate the fact that there are decent people living in the inner city. Donald Trump's comment a few weeks ago about Black people and how they have nothing to lose seems to indicate that he believes that all Black people are street, so to speak.
I know.
All Black people are in this situation and are, you know, buying into the street values, but that's not true. My research has shown that the community itself is divided between street and decent. And most Black people in these communities are decent and trying to be decent. They go to church. They try to raise their families well. They try to teach their kids right from wrong. And for the most part, the kids know right from wrong and do behave that way.
Yes.
But it's the street element that gets promulgated. It's the street element that gets celebrated by the larger society in movies and books and, you know,
music.
Films, all of that, music,
yeah.
All of that. But life in the community is far from that, if you follow me.
Most definitely. And one thing that struck me as really important to note is that people within the community and outside of the community, so let's say teachers in the schools or potential employers or people in public spaces like these varying degrees of canopies, have trouble discerning who is a decent, law-abiding person with wonderful values and who is someone who lives by the code of the street, simply because the style of dress tends to be the same in order to project an air of don't mess with me, I can handle myself. So tell me a little bit about the necessity of presenting oneself as someone who is capable of violence.
Well, in order to survive in the community, it's important even for the decent young people to act as though they can handle the streets, that they can hang.
Mm-hmm.
so to speak. And these kids are code-switching oftentimes. But to have any credibility, one has to dress the right way. One has to look the right way. One has to some extent, mimic the street, even though within deep down inside, the kid might be a decent kid all the way. But decency doesn't get you very much on the streets, you see.
Sure, and so, respect.
Right, exactly. Respect is the currency. Respect is it. Street credibility, respect, that's the currency. At the same time, it's important to appreciate the fact that the larger society has an image of the black community. I think this is what Donald Trump was trying to get at, you know, this iconic ghetto. See, the iconic ghetto can be traced back to slavery. After slavery, blacks migrated to cities, and of course they were contained in black communities. And slavery established the black body at the bottom of the order, and the ghetto communities that developed reinforced this position. And over the years, we've had this the civil rights movement, we've had the racial incorporation process, which meant that the black middle class grew, and it has grown. It's the largest in history, and many black people today live outside the ghettos. They live in middle class communities.
Of course.
They work in corporations. They work in universities. They work in government. They're in many situations and places where they used to just not be. But the iconic ghetto is so strong, so powerful as an image, that basically it tends to supersede this position, the status, you see. And so it becomes a kind of master status that people use to define black people. So as black people move about in the larger society, they oftentimes have to disabuse people of the idea that their ghetto stereotypes apply to them, you see. And this is part of the problem. Again, what was going on perhaps in what Donald Trump was trying to say, you know, because he has this image of the iconic ghetto, you know, which a lot of people have of the black community.
Right.
Without any recognition that that the huge black middle class exists outside the black community, because you, these people have black skin, you see, and that black skin associates them with the hood, with the ghetto, you see.
Absolutely.
But many people don't live there anymore.
Right. And you say that that middle class blacks and affluent blacks feel the need to claim and demonstrate their place in society because they feel like they are being judged as having been from the ghetto and just a generation or two from the ghetto. And they really feel like they need to dress better than others and drive better cars than others in the community, than people of other races, to show that they belong there. So tell me a little bit about that mindset of middle class blacks and what they deal with when people, like what Donald Trump said, kind of lumps everyone with dark skin together into that stereotypical ghetto mindset.
See, middle class blacks run into this all the time because of the phenotype and black skin. They're associated, you know, with the ghetto before they can prove that they're anything else. So it involves quite a bit of work, so to speak, for them as they deal with the larger society, much of which is unenlightened. We've had a civil rights movement. We've had an incorporation process. We've had a growth of the black middle class. And yet, as black people move about in the larger society, because of the iconic ghetto, they move about with the deficit of credibility in the minds of so many other people. And so in order to deal with this so-called deficit of credibility, they have to disabuse people of the idea that the ghetto stereotypes apply to them, you see.
Right.
And this is the work that black middle-class people oftentimes have to do in order to get treated fairly, to get treated as law-abiding and decent citizens of this country.
That takes us to the cosmopolitan canopy, when in an integrated space, blacks really have to navigate and think and plan a lot more than whites do, because they are so conscious of how they're being perceived and how they are interacting. So tell us a little bit about the extra societal burden that Blacks of all socioeconomic statuses have to bear when in integrated public spaces?
Well, it goes back again to the iconic ghetto. See, the iconic ghetto is not only this place, quote unquote, where the Black people live, supposedly, but it's also a very deep source of stereotype and prejudice and discrimination. And Black people in the larger society have to deal with that all the time, you know. It hovers over American society, unfortunately. Even the President of the United States runs into this problem too, you know, because people are ready to assume so much that's negative about him simply because of the color of his skin and the way the color of his skin is related to the so-called iconic ghetto. And for him, that ghetto is Chicago or even Kenya to some people. If you listen to Donald Trump's early remarks about Bertha and all that, the iconic ghetto, it's always there as a referent point, you see.
Mm-hmm.
The place where people can refer Blacks to. And it's ultimately discrediting, and Black people deal with it by working to disabuse people of the larger society that those stereotypes apply to them. So this becomes work. And once it's done, once the work is done, and the person deals with the so-called deficit of credibility, unfortunately, the person then simply moves to a provisional status, oftentimes, that is having something more to prove. And this is really the problem of the new and emerging Black middle class today. People with phenotype that refers them to the ghetto, but with skills and education and whatever that allows them to make claim on the best values of the larger society, you see.
Yes.
So this is the problem that Black people have today.
And I saw a Pew Research study that came out a few weeks ago that struck me, that said that affluent African Americans tend to live in areas that are lower than their socioeconomic status, simply because it is less work and they feel more comfortable and less judged to take a step down in socioeconomic status of neighborhood.
And what we have here really is the legacy of racial caste in America. We don't have a caste system in America, but we have something that mimics that. And in the old days of slavery, of course, there was clearly this caste system. And over time, this caste system has become gilded, and it has allowed people to be mobile. And we're dealing right now with the legacy of that caste system, which has implications for how Black people and white people relate to one another.
For sure, for sure. And I think that a lot of people simply don't understand that legacy continues and that work must be done to stop that legacy from perpetuating. I mean, when you wrote Code of the Street, you made a very prophetic statement at the end that if we don't address the situation of the inner city, of the iconic ghetto, of the extreme poverty, that racial tensions and societal tensions are going to get worse. And in the years since you've written that, that is clearly happening now with, you know, the police shootings and the demonstrations and riots and racial tensions, at least from my perspective in my lifetime, have never been higher than they are right now. And so do you have any prescription for how we can address that and how we can inform people who are not aware that we all need to play a part in rectifying the situation so that we can live together in a cosmopolitan canopy with the same code?
Mm-hmm. I have to believe that education is very important. Education, and I'm talking here about a kind of civic education that we need to somehow promote, and it's through programs like your own and other commentators and documentaries that can illuminate these real conditions that we live in. I think that's the way we advance. Really, we need the education because we have grown. We have had a civil rights movement. We've had a racial incorporation process. We've had the growth of a large black middle class. And at the same time, there are many people who are not convinced, not convinced. And so when they see black people, when they encounter black people, they want to relate to them as though they're in a caste position. And some of the people have not gotten the news, so to speak. And I think education, civic education, is a big piece of this. The recognition that we have these problems, that we live with this legacy, this is what we need to understand. And then we can begin to raise questions and hopefully do something about it.
And I think fear, honestly, plays a large part in it, because there is the assumption out there that young black males can all be dangerous. And so it's hard for a young black male to get a job. It's hard for a young black male to not be harassed and viewed as someone who is a potential criminal. In a paper you recently wrote, you talk about a law school student who was sitting at the bus with his books and his groceries waiting to go back to his apartment. And he was suddenly swarmed by a dozen policemen and spread on the ground and accused of, you know, having committed a crime, and he didn't know what was going on. So as he was asking questions, they were telling him to stop resisting. And I think a lot of people don't realize that is a common experience among young black males of all education levels, all socioeconomic classes, all geographic locations. And over time, a little bit of bitterness develops because they feel like they can never, ever be fully accepted without being feared. So how do we address that fear?
Well, again, recognition of the fact that we have the problem, I think, is a big part of it. The legacy of caste, this is what we're saying here. Mm-hmm. This is what this young man is living with, and we need to address it. We need to educate people. We need to hold policemen and others accountable when they do these things. When they don't treat black people as full citizens, we need to address the issue. And I think we have to work to enlighten people about this issue. And that's, you know, we've come a long way, but we have so far to go.
We do. We have so far to go. And I think that the greatest challenge is in that inner city where there is a different code and it's a different world, and they have grown to resent the outside world, and the outside world has grown to resent them because there's a misunderstanding, there's a fear, and even within the community, those who are extremely decent people are posturing to appear that they could be dangerous for their own safety, because that's what they have to do. Within those communities, what can parents do? What can teachers do? And what can social services do? What can be done to make that posturing unnecessary?
Well, again, I go back to the issue of civic education, and we need to educate our public servants. We need to perhaps socialize them to the fact that we have these complicated social issues to deal with, much of which has to do with this legacy of racial caste. We need to make clear that the iconic ghetto itself hovers over race relations in this country. And as it hovers over race relations, it basically places black people in a position of having to work for any recognition of their humanity, their civility, their education. All of this needs to be understood, appreciated. At the same time, it's very important to solve the problems, the macro problems that are going on in our communities and our cities. And I think really that nothing short of a kind of a Marshall Plan for our cities is in order to deal with the fact that so many of the jobs and the opportunities have left these communities, not simply black communities, but urban communities in general.
Yeah.
And we need to do something about that, because that's a big, big, big source of the problem right there.
Yes, and in Code of the Street, you tell a story of one particular young man who seemed to really be trying to get a job and live on the straight and narrow, and he was coming from a background of the drug economy, which essentially there were no jobs, and so if you wanted to be able to have any income in his area, you had to sell drugs. And so he was trying to overcome that and trying to get into a 9-to-5 or an 8-to-7, seemed very willing to work, but really struggled with that. So tell me a little bit about those personal struggles as an example of the difficulty of rising above that community without the availability of jobs within close proximity.
The fact that the jobs have largely disappeared from the urban areas, mm-hmm. I think that's a very important consideration here. And so many people, as they come out of school, as they emerge from these communities, have no hope for the future.
Yeah.
Because the jobs are just not there. They're not there, and we need to do something about that. This is a big part of the problem. And when the jobs are not there, of course, young people make money any way they can.
Mm-hmm.
And the underground economy is out there beckoning to them. At the same time, the role models that used to be there, hardworking men involved in the manufacturing economy, many of those role models are no longer existent, or they are simply not paid attention to. As I said, I think that in order to deal with this problem, we're going to have to do some big thinking or rethinking about the economy. I think we're going to have to develop a kind of a Marshall Plan for the cities of this country. This isn't just Philadelphia. It isn't just New Haven. It isn't just Pittsburgh. It isn't just Youngstown. It isn't just Bridgeport or Chicago. But there are cities all over the country that are going through the same problems, and we need to address that issue.
Once the drug trade has become so prevalent in a community, it seems to be, as you described, self-sustaining, because drug dealing as itself is somewhat predatory, because your goal is to get customers who are going to come back. And so right. You talk about people getting their friends and family members addicted to drugs, which then renders those people incapable of really seeking anything other than the next fix, which leads to further crime and prostitution, which then further degrades the area. So it seems like it's a cycle that the only way to stop this cycle is by jobs. The only way to stop this is to provide alternate options for these young men and women as they are growing up.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's important for your listeners to understand, too, that in the community, and I know we said this in the opening of the program, there are quote-unquote decent people in the community, and there's a street element. And so many of the decent people, quote-unquote, they work for a living, they educate their children, they go to church, they do all these things to get involved with the larger economy to the best they can. Mm-hmm. But the street is a strong pull, you see. And this is a minority of people in the community, but it grows when there's lack of hope for the future and lack of opportunity. And this is what we need to deal with. We need to recognize that, you see.
Sure. And that a lot of the children who are growing up on the street with the street values, it seems that they are there because of neglect, because of drug addicted parents, or because of, you know, like you said, the older generation of community heads, they are slowly disappearing. And the older generation now, the middle-aged generation, is coming up. And some of those people grew up with street values as well. So now we're reaching a point in society where we have the multi-generational street values, and we've got children who are being abused from anger and frustration and or neglected. And so from a micro perspective, what can we do for those kids?
I think that we need intervention on the part of companies, schools, educators. We need neighborhood investment. We need community investment. Mm-hmm. We need to recognize the problems that that deindustrialization have created in these communities, and the fact that jobs have literally disappeared.
Yes. Yes, yeah. And people are doing they're doing the best they can, and once they get caught up in a cycle, it is very, very difficult, as you demonstrated through the stories of you're helping this particular young man get a job and get an attorney and turn himself around, ultimately, you know, ending up back on the street and getting shot. Because once you learn that particular code, any sort of financial gain, any sort of nice things, you say it's necessary to have those things, not necessarily even as a status symbol, but as a sign that you are able to protect yourself from being robbed. That really enlightened me, because I had often wondered, I would see, you know, rappers wearing the gold chains and just wearing so much valuable merchandise on their person. And I never sociologically understood why that had become a cultural phenomenon. And your explanation that, you know, somewhat ostentatiously showing that you have, you know, wads of cash or expensive belongings, it gives you street cred. And since yes. street cred is something that I think most people outside of that world just don't understand. I mean, it's become part of the common vernacular, and people will say, you know, I have, you know, street cred in the accounting industry. And so it's been watered down to the point so much that people don't really understand the origins of street cred. But most of the people who are living in the areas that people are judging as being completely street are not that way at all. And interacting, how do we create more canopies?
My sense is this: the color line persists, but in a new and emergent form. And many blacks now work in a wider range of occupations than ever. Not simply in menial jobs, but in professional positions in which they have rarely appeared before. Doctors, lawyers, professors, corporate executives, and many of them also reside in exclusive neighborhoods, and their children attend formerly white schools. And as black people have become increasingly more visible throughout society, the physical black ghetto persists. This iconography conditions many Americans to think that the black person's place is usually in the ghetto, not in middle-class society, burdening them with the deficit of credibility. And this color line is what we have to deal with today. And it's a very complicated situation, but at least illuminate the conditions and maybe points the way forward. That would be my hope anyway.
Sure, I think so. And we've focused so much on the inner city and on the ghetto, because your book Code of the Street is it's just so phenomenal. Anybody listening, please read this book. I mean, it is extremely enlightening on both a macro and a micro level of the ghetto. But we haven't talked a lot about the middle class and upper class African Americans who are still struggling with that the societal construct in which blacks belong in the ghetto, or that blacks still have ties to the ghetto, or whatever external perceptions that whites or even other blacks are projecting upon them. People automatically mentally connecting them to a lower socioeconomic status and potentially a different moral code, when these are people who have no connection whatsoever, or who clearly have, even if they have cousins and grandmothers and whatnot, who are still living the street code, are being judged as living that code themselves. So tell me a little bit more about the experience of those African Americans in society and what it is like for them to be judged through the lens of the ghetto.
Well, I mean, since the end of the civil rights movement, as I mentioned, large numbers of black people have made their way into settings previously occupied only by whites, though their reception has been mixed. Overwhelmingly white neighborhoods, schools, workplaces, restaurants, and other public spaces remain. and blacks perceive these settings as white space, which they often consider to be informally off limits to people like them. Meanwhile, despite the growth of an enormous black middle class, many whites continue to assume that the natural black space is that destitute and fearsome locality so commonly featured in the public media, that is the iconic ghetto. And white people typically avoid black space, but black people are required to navigate white space as a condition of their existence.
Mm-hmm.
And again, these spaces are perceptual categories, because the city today can be divided up into three types: black space, white space, and of course, as I said, the cosmopolitan or racially mixed space. And these spaces, from what I've been able to understand, are in flux, changing from black to white to black, and sometimes in between, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, white people typically avoid black space, but black people have to navigate white space, and they want to do so in part because that's where the goodies oftentimes are. The decent jobs, the nice restaurants, school, a lot of the things that are of value in the society. So the people who would navigate this larger system are oftentimes doing it in circumstances that they perceive as being maybe off limits to them. And sometimes they're reminded of this by the interaction and the reception that they receive, you see. At the same time, people do what they can to survive. They navigate it. They figure out ways to deal with it. But it's oftentimes no fun when they're stopped or encounter this moment of acute disrespect, which people do encounter from time to time in these settings.
Yeah, and it strikes me that you call this white space because whites don't think about that. I mean, they don't think of it as being they look around and if they see a homogenized area and they don't see a lot of diversity, or they do see diversity but don't even really notice it, they don't think of it as a white space. They just think of it as a space. So
So
what I'm hearing from you is that regardless of socioeconomic status, blacks are always feeling like they have to prove themselves in all areas of society.
Right. It's complicated. I mean, not all blacks feel one way, of course.
Well, of course.
But these are perceptual categories. The perceptual category of black space, the perceptual category of white space, perceptual category of racially mixed space. But again, these spaces, the so-called white spaces, are perceived as spaces that are off limits to them, and they can feel uncomfortable, uneasy, or whatever in these spaces. That doesn't mean that they have to give in and depart, but
of course,
but they have to manage it, if you will.
So, what about you? I mean, you're a sociology professor at Yale. You've worked at the University of Pennsylvania, and clearly you are very separated from that ghetto in your life, in your education level, in your proximity where you're living. What kind of racism do you experience, if you're comfortable talking about that, on a daily basis? What has been your personal experience as somebody that is clearly on a level that people in the ghetto would never reach, but is completely accessible to middle and upper class whites and African Americans? How do you experience racism in that vein?
Well, I'm just about to publish a book entitled Black in the White Space, which tells the whole story.
Oh, okay.
And at least a lot of it, hopefully. But as you suggest, I mean, much of my life is, you know, been in the so-called white space. Again, this is a perceptual category.
Right.
I was born in the Mississippi Delta during the war on a former plantation, and my grandmother was the midwife when I was born. And my father fought in World War II, returned and couldn't live in the South anymore. And the family moved north the south of Bend. My dad had a fourth grade education. My mother had an 11th grade education. And she worked as a domestic. My father worked as a factory worker at Studebaker's, the defunct car manufacturer. Mm-hmm. And I attended the public schools in South Bend and grew up there. And then went away to college to Indiana University in Bloomington. And from there, I received a fellowship at the University of Chicago. And from the University of Chicago, I was recruited to Swarthmore College. I taught there for 2 years. And then I was recruited by Penn. And I taught there for many, many years. And then I was recruited by Yale. And so I started at the symbolic bottom of American society.
Right.
And now, today, I operate at the symbolic top of American society.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a story of that trek from point A to point B. And to a large extent, what we're talking about is living in what could be perceived as white space, a space that is dominated by white people and essentially controlled by white people, as it were.
Right.
So this is part of my story, but it's also the story of many, many black middle class people today.
Absolutely.
And this incorporation process I speak of is a process that I know intimately because I've experienced it, you see.
Yes, I did a show last year. My next door neighbor and her husband grew up in the Bronx River Project in New York City, and so she wrote a memoir about their, you know, growing up there and how they now live in a upper middle class area. It's sad to me that it is still remarkable when someone comes from, as you said, what is considered the bottom ring of society, and comes to the top of society, that when a black person makes that transition, it's still remarkable.
And certainly there are issues all the time that you deal with. And as I point out in my essay, The White Space, the reception of blacks in this kind of space has been mixed. I mean, people have been receptive, but not totally, if you will. So it's complicated. It's not a simple thing at all.
I would imagine so.
But the problem of the white space, as I say, is a problem that black people as a group kind of recognize. You know, again, it's a perceptual category.
Right.
And when I say that, it's a set of issues that black people know they have to manage, so to speak. And they do so typically very, very well, you know, but
yeah.
It is a situation, a set of circumstances that people have to manage. I'm trying to represent what I've come to know both as an academic, but also as a person. So.
Yeah, and your work has really opened my eyes to this because, you know, through walking through a market, a farmer's market, or a set of stores in the most integrated cosmopolitan canopy, it would never have occurred to me that someone else was having to think and alter their behavior and add an additional layer to every action that they would take for fear of being perceived a certain way. And so that was one of the most profound things that I think I've ever read on any topic, is just that there's so much going on in the minds of other people, in others. I mean, any other demographic, you know, men, women, racially, nationality, heterosexual, homosexual, transgender. I mean, you just, a lot of times you don't think of those extra levels. When you have a certain level of privilege, you don't think about the additional actions that are necessary with people who don't have that privilege.
And I'd love
to have you back when your new book comes out to talk about it.
Well, I'd love to come back.
Yeah, I mean, we could go on for 3 hours. I mean, there's so much information there. I mean, there's just so much. Like, there's no way that you can comprehensively cover this topic in an hour. But I do think that we've covered it enough for people to understand a little bit more about how we got where we are. I'm so glad my car got towed. If my car had not gotten towed, this interview would never have happened. And so
well,
I'm so thankful.
Well, Germantown Avenue was just an interesting street for sure. And all the different aspects of the city of Philadelphia are represented right on that street.
Yeah. Yeah, they really are. They really are. It's really amazing. Well, Elijah Anderson, thank you so, so much for being with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Well, you're most welcome.
And for The Authentic Woman, this is Shannon Fisher. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.